Today is Monday, August 21st, 2023. This is part 17 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan spells his name A-L-L-E-N, last name M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T. And my name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm just fine.
Great.
Beautiful day here, but we're going to have, like, going into the hottest days of the summer, it's going to be 96 real temperatures here.
Oh, my gosh.
Going up to actually over 100, which is, with the dew point at over 75 to 80 inches.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
I'm glad I got a pool to
yeah.
And a good air conditioner.
Good. Lovely. Alan, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Last time, you had told us quite a bit about the work, the really important work that you had done on the on Lake Powell and the reservoir behind Glen Canyon Dam. And then that we started talking a little bit about Lee's Ferry. Can you pick that thread up?
Yes, that's what I'd like to kind of, yeah, the thread is right. It's kind of tangled because so many things happening at the same time. I was working for the park. I was recuperating. I was a lot of things going on, and I'll try to straighten it out now as to what and how, and it may seem off on a couple of digressions, but it'll all come together in the end, I hope. Around 2000, in the year 2000, in May, I retired from the school district. I had my points, as they say, and happily went on from there. I worked on the lake basically that summer. Usually I had to quit there early because school started, but not in 2000. I was able to work longer and do several months. And then in the fall, I, of course, was looking for something to do. I didn't have any real job plans other than seeing what the park could do. And I the project over the winter was some work down at Lee's Ferry, and I just really loved that. And working for the resource management, that's what I wanted to say, because in the park there are different divisions, rangers, the interpreters. Resource management has a large staff, mainly archaeologists, and one can add historic people. And I got to know them well and really felt that was where my future, if I could figure a way to pull it off.
Okay.
I really liked, because I told you last time that in Fredonia and out at Moccasin and at Pipe Springs, we just had a constant flood of Mormon history that was all that same time and included Lee's Ferry.
Ah.
It was a very key part of the whole history there. So to go back, the I shouldn't try to really deal with dates too much, but I don't.
Okay.
2002 was a key one that I'll come to in a minute. But at Lee's Ferry, some background on the place, on what I dealt with personally, was the when the dam was built and Glen Canyon National Recreation Area was developed, it included down to Lee's Ferry, and that was the 15 miles of Glen Canyon that wasn't flooded, and then the access point down there. And of course, at Lee's Ferry is where all the Grand Canyon River trips start, and eventually the boundary of Grand Canyon National Park came to, up to Lee's Ferry also, so that the Colorado was completely in the National Park Service.
Right.
When the Park Service took over Lee's Ferry, there was several historic buildings down by the launch ramp. We called the fort, Spencer Building, a couple geologic survey buildings that had been there since the 30s and 40s. There was a dugout that had more or less collapsed. And then there were two buildings upstream at the old ferry crossing, that where the ferry actually operated up till 1929.
Upstream, maybe a quarter mile or so from the...
No, it's more like a mile.
A mile, okay.
Yeah, it's a good mile from the launch ramp.
Okay.
And the park committed itself to, it had to take care of those things. Down at the, it was kind of unfortunate, but down at the fort and the, what they called the post office, the Lee's Ferry post office, and actually it's called the Charlie Spencer office, really, later years, there was a chain link fence around those, and between the two buildings with this big boulder with a plaque from the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers saying Lee's Ferry, and in his few sentences telling why this was one of the most important spots to Utah, Arizona history that exists anywhere. And I'm not being facetious, because I'm convinced that that's the only reason the historic buildings were not touched. Because the park and the concessionaires and everyone down there, they would happily just, they took out all the old historic mining buildings and USGS buildings and left those two, basically. And I'm really happy that they did, because that's part of the history. And I always joke that thank goodness none of the park people would dare go up against the Daughters of the Utah Pioneers.
But weren't a number of the buildings actually knocked down in the 1960s when the park realized they could knock them down because they were only 49 years old, and if they waited for another year, they would actually have to be responsible for the buildings. I may have that story wrong.
That's the park and the Bureau. It was collusion at the time. It took a year or two for the Park Service to actually, with Congress to, there's a term for what it does to actually set aside a national park area. So in between there were rangers there, the park had maintenance people there, but the Bureau was still there. The USGS had buildings, and fortunately they were still using them, or the combination. It wasn't just the park. And there's a point that I that there's a lot of rumor through all the historic areas and thing about this 50-year rule for the Park Service on historic structures.
Hmm.
What the rule actually says is that if a building is over 50 years old and you want to destroy it, tear it down, or even modify it in a major way, you have to do a historic evaluation by a third party, preferably, and present it to the state historical officer, the SHPO, and to get to confirm it before you can tear it down. Now, if you find that it has historic value, you have to at least make an effort to research and show the different possibilities you could do with it, including going from completely preserving at one end and tearing it down, bulldozing it at the other.
Okay.
But you'd have to justify it. And there's lots of old buildings that were 50 years old that are gone and should have been. You know, it's just what happens when you're developing or returning an area to less development. But the 50-year rule just says that you have to evaluate the buildings, and if they're historic, you have to go through certain stages before you tear them down.
Okay.
And so that, I found that issue come up lots of times. But the buildings down at the fort, at this time, this was 1972, the park officially, it was before that, it was in the late 70s.
Right, it was in the 60s, and it was before the formation of the SHPO, the State Historic Preservation Offices, before that legislation came in, I believe, in the 70s.
Yeah.
So we have to kind of go back a ways. And the park, well, the monument, the recreation area, was enabled by Congress, not by Congress, but by the Department of Interior in the 50s. And it wasn't until, as you say, in the 70s when Congress actually passed legislation about it, but
yeah,
the recreation area was there and was operating from the 50s forward.
Right. The key thing I was going to bring up was that the Lonely Dell Ranch at the mouth of the Paria River,
right,
which is about 2 miles, well, it's just a mile from the river, but you have to drive 2 miles to get to it.
Okay.
That was still private property.
Okay.
And in Glen Canyon, it was about half a square mile that was patented land there. And the family that had a fantastic history, which I won't go into, but I want to dwell on what happens next. And it was a prime part of the historic system there, but it was privately owned. The historic buildings were owned. The irrigation ditches and the cemetery, everything like that. In the late 50s, or 60s actually, the family that had lived there and farmed there last were elderly and moved on. The son didn't want it. And they sold it to a consortium in Phoenix of developers. And they actually were set up to sell this prime property to the park at a profit. But the park didn't really have the money and for several years in the late 1971 or 72, the consortium kind of gave up, and I got pictures of the huge sign at the gateway to the ranch, lots for sale.
Oh, wow.
Mobile home lots. Come and bring your trailer and put it on, you know, buy a lot here. They did that basically just to force the park into buying it. The park went to arbitration. The guys didn't get what they expected out of it, and the park paid more than it wanted to. But in 72, the park got the Lonely Gull Ranch.
Okay.
And somewhere in that thing, like you say, the whole SHPO, the state historic offices of the National Park Service supported and encouraged and got the rules that every state had to have one.
Right.
And it was has done good all over Arizona, protecting and preserving historic structures. And so they originally had a Lee's Ferry Historic District and the Lonely Dell Ranch Historic District. Each of them had five or six buildings and structures that were historically significant. And they had historians come through, including Crampton, and Russo helped, worked with him to develop that, which structures were important. And like later years, they combined the two into one historic district, and it's now technically the Lee's Ferry Lonely Dell Ranch Historic District, and they're connected in one big area. The problem with the Park Service, and I've said this many times, and even in official meetings and all, is the park had a way of taking historic buildings, evaluating, noticing they needed lots of maintenance, getting a crew from somewhere else of historic restorers who were paid fantastic amounts of money to come and rehab the buildings, get them in a state that they were going to so-called, you know, would remain forever, but that wasn't the case because the park tended to rehab the buildings there, all of them, and then lock the door and walk away. And 5 or 6 or 10 years later, someone would notice, oops, the building's fallen down.
Mm.
What happened, you know? So in the early 90s, there was a major push to really rehab all the buildings and set it up down there at Lee's Ferry. And the park, mainly run by the Regional Historic Preservation Office in Santa Fe, contracted for a complete historic inventory. And that was done in the late 60s. A large group of students and historians. And in 1999, their report was published. And if you're interested sometime, you should get a copy of it because it's just amazing. And that was when I was back and forth and in and out and saw that report and discussed it and was in meetings when it was discussed and everything. But that became the Bible to the park as to what to do in the future. And I was directly involved in everything from then on. At the same time, D.G. Riley's book was published.
Right.
Now, you know his whole story, obviously. I don't need to include it here, except that the researchers for the Park Service relied heavily on Riley's PT's research.
Okay.
Because instead of just finding out a bunch of family histories and legends, which is, you know, they're interesting and they tell a lot about the families and the history, but they don't necessarily have much in fact. And you know, and I'll just say this much, that PT, which I really became to respect him, though he had passed away before this time, and his book was published posthumously by his family. And I couldn't remember the guy that edited D.T. Riley's book. He lives in Flagstaff.
That's Bob Webb, isn't it?
Webb, that's it. Robert Webb, yes. I've met him several times. But he did a marvelous job in editing and presenting and really didn't change much of the original writing. But what Riley had done was he was a river runner and waiting to take trips out at Lee's Ferry for many, many years, he just by coincidence got to know the locals and a lot of the Johnson family and people in the Marble Canyon area, and he was fascinated with their history. And he did the most important thing, is he decided to, well, what you're doing is he interviewed them all.
Right.
And he taped and wrote down and typed every interview, mainly typed them out, wrote them out in handwriting. But he went to the actual, to the source, to the first level, what do you call it, the most, when there's a historic event, you go to the actual people who were there.
Yeah, the primary source.
And, yeah, primary source material. And he found that most of them were still there and alive. And he's dedicated several, I don't know, 20, 30 years of his life researching and searching out all over Utah, Southern California, Arizona, not so much documents or photographs, but the actual people who were there and did the event and what, and got their side of it. And that was so rare and so valuable and important that it's the reason Lee's Ferry had an excellent historic background. Now that his book was published and the park historic evaluation was published, because the park's book by that was a group of historians that back east did that sort of thing, but they came out and looked at all the photographs they could find, especially at the Klein Library, and spent a lot of time there copying and getting all the documentation in that library at NAU, and then at the Huntington Library in California, up in any place that was documents and photographs, they went and copied them and trying to build a construction history of these buildings. Because they went through such an evolution over the years.
Right.
So that report is almost 2 inches thick.
Do you know the name of that? The name of that report?
Well, I was looking for it, and I'm pretty sure I don't have one anymore in my library. I should try again. I gave it to the fellow that replaced me up at Lawyers at Long Rendell. But it's the historic evaluation of Lee's Ferry Long Rendell Ranch National Historic District.
Okay.
And they published the history of everything that happened there, starting with Dominguez Escalante camping there for several days on their trip what little they could find about fur trappers and people coming from Arizona up and back, the early explorations of the place, the river runners, the buildings themselves, and they were able to establish a good sequence of each building on when it was built, who built it, what it looked like. Either they made drawings or they had photographs, and then photographed all the changes that happened over the years. And they also, the important part was, they really evaluated the value of these areas.
Hmm.
What, why was the park have to commit to preserving these buildings?
Right.
And that took kind of a battle, because there were many voices that saying no, just even in Lonely Dell Ranch, there were resource management directors saying we should just tear it all down, plow it over, plant cactus, and return it to the desert.
Hmm.
And fortunately, other people, and especially the locals and the historians, the family groups and all, spoke out and made a very strong point for preserving what's there. But anyway, to get this story, because I do want to, it's part of it that I really enjoy telling. So I had retired in 2000. 2020, the winter of 2001-2002, a friend and I, who was an interpreter also and in the same boat, they asked me if I would volunteer to do a couple projects.
Okay.
Down at Lee's Ferry. And this other guy, which I can't remember his name, I can picture him perfectly, but that'll come up to me soon. But the deal was, if we were seasonal employees for the 6 months, we could not be hired in that position for another 6 months.
Okay.
After it had passed. But the next 6 months, like the winter for me, I could be hired by the rangers or resource management or maintenance. The thing was very strict. You couldn't volunteer in your old position, because idea was that people would think that, oh, you volunteered, so they hired you, because you volunteered, or if that was expected as part of the job, to work for so many months and volunteer for so many months, and that for whatever reason. But anyway, I started working for resource management as a volunteer, and We went, my friend and I went down and evaluated the petrified forest at Lee's Ferry. And most of the public doesn't realize that there is a huge petrified forest up on what we call the benches, which you drive in on the lower level to these areas, and above you there's this first plateau.
Right.
And beyond, behind that is the huge Korea plateau. But there's quite a level, flat bench back there, and it's for maybe over 10 miles. It's just very, very full of petrified wood.
Okay.
And a forest. And we did, and I want to mention that, you know, when I say we used GPS and we surveyed the location, presented a huge map showing every log.
Wow.
And data with it on how long it was, the diameter, and what condition it was in. But we had a GPS. It was one of the first that the park had.
And wow.
People today have no concept what we went through, because it was a big machine.
Oh, my gosh.
It sat on a large tripod, and on top of that was a box with a dome on top. And then you hand-carried this thing that operated it. You plugged in and typed it in, and the amazing part was that the satellites had to be right, because the satellites that were, the GPS was reflecting the signal off the satellite, and the machine was getting the signal to tell where it was, and they were moving, and the earth was turning, and down in the canyon of Lee's Ferry, even though it's broad, we'd set up at a log and look and say, oops, there's only two satellites, because it would tell us, and it would say, you have to wait until three satellites are there. And we'd sometimes wait 10, 20 minutes, and all of a sudden it would beep and say it was ready, and we'd take our reading quickly, and once we figured it out, we'd have several logs lined up, and we'd, fast as we could, move the whole operation log to log while we had a signal.
Huh.
And back then, you know, it was down to accuracy of maybe a meter or two, which was incredible in those days. But, you know, it took a lot of work to do basically all the logs across there, hundreds and hundreds of them. But I volunteered for that. And it was several months that we did that down there until we basically got to all of them down above Marble Canyon Lodge down there.
Huh.
But I really, you know, got to know the people in research management, the archaeologists, and the younger staff there. They didn't have a real historic resources person, but they all kind of did the best they could. But this comes down to when the next year in I'll go back to when that report for the park was published, what they did, which was great, is either part of the report or part of what they recommended and all but demanded was that the park hire a major restoration to come in and really repair the buildings, because the technical term, which I love, is that every building there had suffered catastrophic collapse.
Oh, wow.
Which was much blunter than I would have said, but all of them except the ranch house at the ranch, which the park put a metal roof on to protect it by some luck, because that preserved the building. Every other building that's down at the fort, the log cabins, when you looked up inside, you could see the blue sky.
Oh, wow.
Through the roof. Most of them hadn't collapsed completely, but were on the verge of it. The roofs were just, had not been maintained and were gone. And fortunately, the response was to, well, we got to fix this. And it was scheduled in 2002, late spring, my numbers, I've got to be careful here. And I actually looked up the next thing, because this was at the height of the hantavirus concern. There were many, people were catching it, and they didn't know what it was or where it came from. And long story there as to, people were dying from it in the Four Corners area.
Right.
Flagstaff to Page to, in general, the Navajo reservation, which was unfair to them by coincidence. They got it worse than others. And it eventually, the long story detective work, they found that it was the mice that were carrying the virus. And in there, the mouse nests in buildings, and especially all the place where they peed around with the mouse droppings and all, was virtually everyone that caught it was cleaning out an old shed or a wood shop or something.
Right.
And said that, they cleaned out a big mouse nest in there. And so it became very critical that everyone clean out mouse droppings and stuff carefully. And so they asked, I don't know to this day if the archaeologist, out of luck or knew me, the strange sides of my personality, but asked if I would be trained and get the equipment and go down and clean out the buildings, do a complete antivirus as that, because the crew that they had contracted with that was coming from Maryland, the park has actually national historic building repair program in it's a school that you can go to, and part of the graduation is going to a park and restoring a building.
Okay.
So they had contracted with them that they were going to send 6 or 8 people out, but they were not going to come until the antivirus was resolved.
Got it.
And I I know, well, I don't see any reason why I can't. So I read everything I could on it. I contacted the maintenance guy at the South Rim who was dealing with it and understood, because there were no, you know, OSHA rules yet. This was coming, and they had agreed on the 10% Clorox in, or no, it's chlorine in Clorox in water to spray and soak the area with the, especially the droppings, and cause that's where the mice would pee on it too, which was a dangerous thing. So they bought me a complete hazmat suit.
Okay.
You know, it was just rubber boots and coveralls. And then the good part was this big rubber, it's like a shawl. It went over my head and my shoulders. Mm. And it had a respirator pack on my back with a big, the filters that they had, you know, approved for doing this for hantavirus. The person could, the air, because it was just taking the air in the building and filtering it and then pumping it into my suit there, the head part of it. And it was very comfortable, really.
Nice.
The part that I found in first trying it was that, yeah, I needed the filters that got rid of the virus, and there were plenty of options for that. But I had to have one that got rid of the chlorine, too.
Oh.
Because when you'd spray down the whole interior of a room and let it just soak in, because these rooms were covered with an inch or more of dust and dirt and stuff that had blown in, and it had to be just soaked through with the Clorox before you could then shovel it into contractor bags and tie it up, double bag it, and put it in the dumpster. Fortunately, that's once it was, the chlorine killed it, and you could just discard that. But I, you know, did all the buildings down there. Started with at the ranch, the log cabins and the dugout there, and the other built the picture window cabin, we called it, and I. And it took quite a while. It was a couple of weeks that I would drive down from Page and add all my gear and get the stuff mixed up and the use just a garden sprayer.
Okay.
Maybe 2 gallons at a time, and spray it down, let it sit for a couple hours. Go to another building, spray it down, and come back and clean out the first building, and then go clean out the second building. And it meant in these areas where there was the roofs that collapsed, it was kind of cleaning all the debris there, the walls and the rafters and everything where a mouse could have run around.
And it
was turned out very successful. I to this day, I have good memories of doing that. I was all by myself, and the weather was beautiful and all. But by coincidence, the last building I did was down at the fork. I did all the other buildings down there, and then came in to do the building on the fort. And have you been in the building there at all?
No, and how do you mean by the fort?
It's at the launch ramp. It's the long stone building with a dirt roof.
Is that the one that has Hislop's inscription on it from the Stanton expedition?
Yes.
Okay, got it. Yes.
And that was the last building. And I remember vividly that, it takes an hour, 45 minutes to drive from Page, getting my stuff all out and mixed up and ready to go, and went in. And in that building, there were three what we called gun ports, because they were narrow slotted windows in the stonework that they had built into it, because when the fort was built, the Mormon Church sent a crew out there from St. George to build the building to protect the ferry from the Indians, because it was a period there where there was skirmishes between all the different settlers and the Navajo, and it never turned into a big war or anything.
But, right.
They put it up, put the gun ports in there, just more or less to show what it could be if anyone was attacked. You could, inside, the windows were very wide and it came down to this narrow slot, so you could actually look quite an area sweep away from the fort where you could, if anyone was attacking. It was never attacked and never used.
Right.
The point was that it was not open to the public either, to protect it, because people would cover it with graffiti and carve in their names and all of that. But over the years, I figured it hadn't really been opened but for maybe 10 years. Just occasionally park people would go in and look around and see what was there and
okay.
Enjoy it. It was a neat place. But so for about 5 years since the antivirus came up, the park agreed, don't go in any old historic buildings, and then it became, don't go into it unless Alan has done so. And that's the way it was. But I went into the fort there, and there was a lot of trash. People, because those ports, gun ports, did not have glass or plexiglass. It was open, and people would just throw junk in. Lots of pop cans and just trash and sticks. And there were several big mouse nests and a huge pack rat's nest. And I first went in with just a plastic bag to clean up, spray down this trash, get it bagged up, and then come in and spray down the dirt, because it was thought to be a dirt floor. And it was dirty at the time, but so I picked up some trash that people threw in, some of the tour guides, some newspaper, whatever they wanted. But then under one of those windows, I went to pick up something that I thought looked like kind of a rolled up old magazine, because there was writing on it and it was twisted up. But it was heavy. And I could say, well, this isn't normal trash. And I kind of brushed it off with the broom that I had and opened up the thing, because it was lead.
Okay.
And I opened up to find this lead tablet about 10 by 12 inches, and there was a bunch of writing on it, as inscribed on it, and it was as if you took some really heavy aluminum foil and wrote with a ballpoint pen, get like that. But this was an old piece of beat up lead, obviously, and there was text on it, and it said from 1872, and it was signed by John D. Lee.
Wow.
And my first reaction was, whoever was the dummy that, whatever this is, whoever made it, they really, the joke was on them, because they threw it in the air thinking the Park Service would find it and get all excited, but nobody went in there for years and years and years. And whoever had done it must have, you know, kicked himself for the fact that the park never, that whatever he did never had any effect, or whatever the thing was. But two things. The first one, everyone agreed that I did, that I was right. I brushed it off. I had my spray can, and I wasn't taking anything out of there without antivirus, you know, disinfecting it.
Right.
And I sprayed it down good with the chlorine, both sides, and let it drain off. And then I went outside and put it on the seat of my truck, and I thought, well, this, whatever this is really weird, and it's, it's got to be evaluated. And, but this was the Friday, the last day before this crew came, and I really had to get this building done. So I said, whatever was there was just going to wait. And so I went in and did the full hazmat. It took all day, probably 6 hours in there. And thinking to myself, you know, whoever, because I knew the building had been restored in the 70s, and another time in the 80s, and now we're getting ready to redo it in the 2001. And I had to look up here. The scroll was discovered in January 2001.
Okay.
It was, I was kind of, well, when I went home to Page, I usually, when I was volunteering like that, and it took so long to get everything set up and broken down and disposed of, and so I usually got up to Page 6 or 6:30 or maybe on to 7, but I went by the headquarters and no one was there, which is what I expected, and I had my keys and went in the basement there where the archaeologist and research management was, and my, considered my boss's on her chair. Actually, that was what we had agreed, that you don't put anything on her desk because it'll disappear. The desk is covered with stuff.
Oh, my God.
And you did put it on her desk chair. So I put the tablet there, and I made a post-it note and said, look what I found.
Wow.
And went home. And the next morning, about 6 in the morning, she calls screaming, like, what is this? This is fantastic, amazing. You've got to get down here. Tell me everything about it. And she just totally freaked out, and most of the rest of the staff did too. Fortunately, I was the only calm person, but I told them what was going on and what I found, and I had researched John D. Lee enough, because the place was named for him, and when he came to start the ferry, he initiated and ran the first wagon trains across the Lee's Ferry, and was hiding out from the federal government for his participation in the Mountain Meadows Massacre.
Right.
And that was all several books had come out on that recently, and so people were aware of John D. Lee and everything about him.
What was the tablet? What had he written on there?
Well, turns out he hadn't, but it was a condemnation of Brigham Young before, and pointing the fingers at Brigham Young for the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And that had been one of the, well, right from the start after it happened, was, did Brigham Young order it,
right,
or not? And the research of the last 10, now 20 years, has proven that he did not. In fact, the message that was sent to Cedar City, where the militia was organizing to attack the wagon train at Mountain Meadows, the message was, do not attack them.
Mm.
Unfortunately, the messenger, even though they tried as hard as they could, they did not get there until, I think, 2 days after the massacre. But, and that would have been, you know, if it was found to be true document, it would have just totally disrupted Mormon history, as much as the massacre did. You know, it was horrible, and the church, you know, was forced to come out again and say, you know, they did not condone it in any way. For me, I'll just mention now that when I end up spending the next couple of years at Lonelydale Ranch, working on the buildings and interpreting it to all the public that came in,
uh-huh,
visitors, a large portion of the visitors were, descendants of John D. Lee. And they would all come to Lee's Ferry, because it was the only place left that you could really see where he had been. It was named for him. It's part of the family lore.
Right.
And one of the places in researching, there was a John Lee family group that was doing genealogy and providing information and doing research and all. And I got one of their brochures, so it would have been after 2000 there, that I said that they're still looking for descendants, and their tree that they had, had 10,000, they had names and phone numbers, addresses of 10,000 living descendants of John D. Lee.
Wow.
And they were looking for more, and they assumed that that was just a small part.
Hmm.
But,
Alan, let me make sure I understand this, though. I'm a little confused here. This lead tablet that you found
Yeah.
was signed by Lee, and basically saying that Brigham Young did authorize the Mountain Meadows Massacre. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And I could, it becomes very complicated because at the same time, in the Salt Lake City, there was a fellow who was a rare book store he had, but got quite a reputation for evaluating historic documents and what was authenticating them, and also pointing out the ones that were that he could prove was obviously fakes.
Okay.
And his name was Fossman, and that was a huge story there, because it turned out he was documenting, or he was creating most of the documents that he was selling to the church and to collectors, and he was just uncanny the way he could recreate historic documents.
Was that Ken Sanders?
Who?
Ken Sanders?
No.
Okay.
This was Hoffman, and it was Fmann.
Okay, and Hoffman was a historian, and he had done a ton of work on Canyonlands. Is that?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
Different guy. All right.
This guy, his peers, meaning other historic document dealers, really got suspicious where he was first discovering these documents, and then authenticating or proving that they were false.
Okay.
And there was a couple in a young couple up in Salt Lake City that were researching and ready to expose that they thought Hoffman was making these documents himself, and he killed them. He murdered them. And it was a big case in Salt Lake, and Hoffman was arrested and tried and sentenced to life in the prison of the Point of the Mountain south of Salt Lake City. And then there was this great despair over in the church over all that they had made for years from the very start, preserve the historic documents, and the church would buy them, church people could buy them, and libraries, and now it was completely up to, is any of it real? And what is real, what is fake? Hoffman wouldn't say anything. I'm pretty sure he died in prison in the last 5 or so, 10 years.
Got it. This is Mark Hoffman.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Now, because suddenly this, of course, was immediately dropped right into the whole, would say circus, but it was a very serious thing because two people had been killed, and in January, I found the thing. The park had some research on it, and definitely some issues. But in March, they made it publicized off to the public. And then there was, at this time, this was a great big deal that this tablet was found. And so they set up a time for a press conference at the fort.
Okay.
I was down there. All the national TV was there with their big trucks with dishes on top. All the major networks and PBS and several non-major, all the newspapers from Phoenix and Salt Lake were there, and I was interviewed several times, more times than I needed to be, and just described what happened. I put it there, and I found it, and then there was discussions. And the one thing I'd like to finish on this is that there were two policemen in Salt Lake that were really responsible for finding out that Hoffman was the criminal and bringing him to justice. And they both had kind of a hobby of historic documents and forensic document work, where you're deciding, and it wasn't all historic, it was just old records that people were pushing. But anyway, they and the Park Service agreed that they had a set of experts that could evaluate the tablet.
Okay.
And the park let them do it. And what it came down to was the lead had actually been mined in Arkansas in the early 1860s. So it could be valid. And the other thing was the sentences. There was lots of Lee's writings, and he didn't write that way. You know, the things that said on the tablet were not his the way he wrote.
Okay.
Many of the spelled words were spelled wrong. That they had record that he spelled right in his other writings. And the thing that's just ended the whole discussion was they found it was written with the point of a nail pressed into the lead sheet.
Okay.
But they found that it was a five-sided point that was common in this country, but it wasn't invented until about 3 years after this lead was the writing was said it was done. So it was obviously done after the fact. It was fake, an interesting fake, but they actually went to prison and asked Hoffman if he did it, and at that time he kept saying, Sharon gave me a post-it note that says Hoffman is still alive.
Oh, okay.
I don't, that's not a believer, but I just had the impression that he had passed away. But I guess what I recall now more is the last ones that interviewed him tried to, that said he just physically he's there, but mentally he's not.
Okay.
Which was happens, because they couldn't really get anything from him. It had, in the end, the researchers that it was fake. It was, they coined a new word, it was false the nest.
Huh.
Meaning it was something that he could have done because it was showed an extraordinary amount of correct stuff with the right lead and the right time and the everything except it had a flaw that Hoffman could have, you know, in great publicity said, oh no, this isn't true. And there's been no one has come forth saying they put it in there. No one has said that they did such a thing. And the consensus is that he made it and sold it to somebody, and then all the controversy came up, and the person felt like they had to get rid of it, and for some unknown reason, rolled it up and came down to the Lee's Ferry Fort and threw it in the window.
Okay.
But that's all conjecture.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the end, I found that I had a good footprint in Lee's Ferry, and I was ready to really found that I loved the place and glad to spend a lot of time there. So
nice.
Next time I might talk about how what became of the buildings and the construction and the maintenance and the
let's do that. Yeah. I did want to mention that the National Historic Preservation Act was passed in 1966.
Okay.
And those buildings were taken out right about that time.
Right.
So I do remember P.T. Riley and others were very upset that these buildings were knocked down. And I don't know that much about it. I haven't researched that personally, but I just remember there was much discussion about that at the time.
Well, there was, and it was the fact that the buildings put up by Charlie Spencer, the gold miner, who had a huge operation there,
right,
were then taken over by the USGS, by the stream gaugers that lived there, and they lived in the old Spencer mining buildings.
Okay.
And when the park took over, they just, some of the guys there decided that all of that should go, and they did bulldoze the Spencer's mining buildings that were wonderful and would have been a great asset down there.
Hmm.
But, and I know that Russo and Crampton and others contacted Stuart Udall and
right.
knew what they were talking about.
Right.
And there was, and they convinced him, but it turned out, he said, he really did a lot, everything he could to try and stop and protect them. But again, the orders came down a day or two after there was the bulldozer destroyed it all.
Right. Yeah, it happened very fast.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
Anyway,
well, this is great. Let's put a comma here in this interview series for today, and we'll pick it up again. This will conclude then part 17 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Alan Malmquist. Today is Monday, August 21st, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Alan, thank you so very much.
Thank you.